back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. The windows are open today. I hope you guys don't mind listening to a couple of birds if you can hear that. I don't know. Usually I have the windows all closed, all soundproof, so I can have some semblance of a studio here. But today I'm just kicking back. I got a little corncob pipe here packed with some Nat Sherman tobacco that I picked up yesterday. And just kicking back on a little day off, if you can call it that. It's really a day of unemployment. It's Memorial Day or Veterans Day or whatever. Let me check which day is it. I want to make sure I get it right. It is Memorial Day, not Veterans Day. Veterans Day, I guess, is in September, right? Am I right? September, November, there's one of those. One of those days that I always get into trouble. I always think I have it off, but I don't. Oh, man. Okay, so the thing is, so today's guest is Bill Kennegeiser. Billiam William Kennegeiser. Big name, right? This guy's a big dude. I'm glad I'm having him on the podcast. Wendy's got the day off. She could come through that door at any point, you know? So I'm trying to get this done quick. If she comes through the door, I think I'm going to leave it in the podcast. What do you guys think? I don't know. She gets a lot of days off. I think she wouldn't because she works corporate. She works for Food Network. You'd think she, you know, would have to work more. But she gets every day off that you can have a day off. They give her off because they're such a good company. It's called Scripps Network. I know that it's not what I'm supposed to be talking about, but I swear to God, she gets a lot of days off. You'd think she was working for the state. You think she was like part of the elevator repairman's union or something. She's here so often. So I'm trying to get this done relatively quick, this little intro, but I want to do a good job because this is a big one. People are starting to listen to this podcast. A lot of people. And I can't thank you guys enough. I mean, it really does. You guys are saving my life here. You know, so she's got the day off and then we got to go to brunch in Brooklyn. I like Brooklyn. It's kind of changed in the last 10 years though. Used to be a bunch of like untalented painters and people eating veggies. Now it's like people killing rabbits. Seriously, there's a place in there where they can kill rabbits, you know, and skin them and eat them. It's like it's a thing. I don't know. The place has gone over the edge. This little hillbilly noir thing out there. You know, you go there, but it's just it's all nonsense too. I mean, Brooklyn is no longer cheap. It's just a bunch of frat boys dressing like they got beat up in high school. It's like I live in the Upper East Side where at least the frat boys, you can tell them they're right in front of you. They're undeniable. But, you know, there's not much of a difference. The boys in my neighborhood are wearing colored pants. It's just their colored pants are a little bit brighter in this neighborhood. You know, I never understood that thing about the rich and elite class feeling like it was okay to wear pink shirts. Never got that. Never got that memo. But anyway, so as I said, we got the biggest guy here, Bill Kennegeiser. Biggest guy we've had on the podcast. No offense to anybody who's been on the podcast before, but this guy is big. This guy is so big, in fact, that I used him. I used his name to try and get sponsors, which I'll talk about in a minute. But right now I want to talk about Bill Kennegeiser. He is a professor at the University of Southern California. He is a Grammy Award winner. He is a founding member of the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, which along with John Dearman, Scott Tennant, and Andrew York. They're first of all, they're the biggest guitar ensemble in the world, no doubt about that. And they sort of shaped how we as musicians, as classical musicians, relate to an audience. I think that they're really good at it. And they were very influential to me at a young age. When you're at an LA guitar quartet concert, you feel like you're maybe at a world music concert or a jazz concert. So it's sort of like jazz, world music, and classical all world, you know, rolled into one. And that's not just because they play Led Zeppelin. I mean, I personally am not, that's not why I listen to them, but they can play anything. They're the finest musicians, some of the finest guitarists in the world. And I think that it's important for us all to take that lesson from them, how important it is to relate to your audience, to be a normal person on stage, you know, and how important it is just to be a normal person when you're a guitarist. I understand that we are pressed for time as performers. And it doesn't always seem like watching a baseball game with your friends is that important. But it really is. You know, because all that stuff creates the nuance that's on stage. I mean, you know, the way I do it is I make sure I get to the bar once a week. I make sure I watch the Jets. And I make sure I watch the Mets. And I return my friends' phone calls. For Christ's sakes. You know, so everybody who, I have a lot of classical musician friends that don't do those things. And they have a lot of reasons. They say, oh, well, you know, I'm just not into pop culture. I'm not into this and that. And it's like, well, you know, a lot of it is that you're lazy. You know, it takes time. It takes time to call a friend back. It takes time. You know, I mean, I have to go out to brunch today. But I'm going to do it. I could just sit here and work on the composition, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it because it's important, because it makes me me. You know, and I think that being a guitarist and also being a person, that's a great combination for stage presence. It's something that Bill Kenningeiser does great. But that's the thing. Be a normal person. It's important that people feel like they're watching people on stage. I've said it before. I'll say it again. But anyway, so this is a big name, as I said, and I used him, and among others, to you know, attract some sponsors. So here's that little story. Here's a story for the week. I probably shouldn't be doing this. I probably shouldn't be divulging this information. Am I misusing a word? I don't know why you guys listen to this. I'm so stupid. What am I doing? Anyway, so I'm gonna share some information with you. I wanted to take this podcast to the next level. So I approached the Guitar Foundation of America, and they have, for those of you who don't know, the biggest convention / competition in our hemisphere, possibly, and possibly the world, for classical guitar. So I contacted some people that I know over there, and I said, what are your advertising opportunities? And they said, well, right now we have the brochure coming up, but you have 72 hours to basically present us with something. At first they tried to bullshit me and tell me that I had like a half an hour, but you know, I was like, okay, well, for real, how much time do I have? They said something, you know, 3 days. So I had 3 days to get together the money for a one-page ad in the brochure for the convention. And I had to get together the money. So I was like, well, I don't want to spend $500 on this. Right now I'm heading towards the summer. And in the summer with the dystonia, I don't get to, you know, perform, and the kids all leave, so I don't get to teach. So I really need to start hoarding a little bit of money, because in 2 weeks I'm going to be basically, you know, backpacking through my apartment for the rest of the summer. And so I approached some people who I thought might be interested in sponsoring me. And one of the guys was totally into it, totally like ready to pay me. Once I gave him the numbers, you know, how many people were listening and how we had grown, you know, over the course of just five episodes, we had grown a lot, and it was like, you know, we were getting younger listeners, and he was attracted to the idea. So much so that he was ready to do it, ready to give me the money. He just said that I needed to mention him on an episode, mention him for a year on all those episodes. I said, that's okay. I said, that's fine. You know, it's a lot. It's a lot of mentions, right? For $500. I don't even know. I don't know how much I'm supposed to be charging. But if you want to know my rate, that's it. $500. I talk about you for a year. Anyway, so I produced a, you know, I produced the ad. And the ad said, what did the ad say? Let me pull it up. What did the ad say? Still have the ad, right? Don't I? Where is it? There it is. Yeah. Okay, so the ad I came up with said, a new free podcast featuring candid, colorful interviews with the musicians, luthiers, educators, and other troubled people who are the fabric of the guitar universe. And then it said Classical Guitar by, you know, Classical Guitar Insider with Brett Williams. And then it said with help from blank. I'm not going to tell you who the person is. But he didn't like the fact that I called them troubled. And I was like, ouch, pal. You should go listen to the podcast. Because if you have problems with the word troubled, me calling them troubled, it gets a little more colorful than that on this podcast, folks. You know, I told him, I said, there's a narrative there. You know, I'm a struggling, artist, both physically, emotionally, and financially. And, you know, I'm trying to reach people on a more visceral level than just simply interviewing people and asking them about their nails and what guitar they play and what strings they use. You know, I mean, that's, I'm trying to get deeper. I'm trying to make an archive of the personalities of the artists here. I didn't, you know, get that heady with them, but I basically just told them very politely to go listen to the podcast, at least for an intro, because the intro pretty much sums up the feeling of what I'm going for. And I said, you know, I'm not swearing as much as I used to, but you know, I mean, I maintain the right to say shit and maybe even words that are worse. You know, I think that that's an important right for me to have. And he passed, you know, and total respect. You know, it's totally fine if you don't want to do it. If you're a family company, I understand you want not to get into bed with me. But the thing is, I don't know, just trying to stick to it. Keep it real, right? I mean, isn't that important? There's nothing, I mean, nobody's talking like this, right? I can't even, you know what? I've been to guitar competitions and stuff like that, and people don't even talk to each other the way that I talk to people on this podcast. So it's an important thing. A little reality check. I got none to lose. I got no performance career right now. Nobody's getting me any jobs. This is a Hail Mary, baby. Take it or leave it. I'm really glad that people are listening, though. And actually, I'm getting a little more self-conscious. I maybe have to pull in the reins a little bit. Do I? I don't want to pull in the reins, but I might have to pull in the reins because, as I understand it, there are some powerful people in my industry. Nobody has a lot of power. We act like everybody is going to save us from this desperate life of being a musician. At the most, if you're nice to somebody, they will get you one concert once in their concert series, unless you're a big name like Anna Vidovic or, you know, someone else. But, yeah. But as far as like, you know, maintaining a certain level of personality during their performances, I didn't mean to take a sharp left turn, but I think it's time to get to the interview. And I think it's time for us to listen to one of the sweetest guys in the business. This guy was a pleasure to talk to. I had no idea it would be so pleasurable. He really, after doing this interview and having it be so easy, it really kind of gave me the will to keep on doing this podcast. So here is the one and only Bill Kenningeisen.
Are we doing this?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
We're doing it.
I'm from New Jersey.
Are you really?
I was born, are you supposed to say what exit?
What exit?
Yeah. I was, actually, I don't know. I was born in Livingston, which is out, you know, it's by the Oranges.
Oh, the Oranges. Is it Orange, New Jersey? Is it?
It's near.
So that is like Fort Lee, a little bit over the bridge, a little bit up.
Yeah.
A little bit up the parkway.
Essex right? County.
Essex County.
And, you know, I grew up there. I went to, you know, when I was in elementary school, my dad got a promotion and we moved the whole family out to L.A. We moved to the San Fernando Valley. And lived there for 4 years.
How old were you when that happened?
I was from 7 to 11. And it was so important for me. Because it was 67. And it was like the Wonder Years. I mean, it was, you know, incredible. And then I went back to Jersey for junior high and high school. But I got the California bug. And when the choice of where to go to college came up. Well, there was an incredible decision to be made. Because I had been going to Manus Conservatory Prep Department.
Oh,
when
okay.
When I was in high school.
Who were you with there?
Herbert Levine.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I was taking ear training and music theory, and the ear training class, that was the thing that...
So this is when Manus was on the Upper East Side?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I went there. That's where I went for grad school.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, with Fred.
It was 94th, right? 94th in Lexington or something like that? Or
oh, man, 70s.
Oh, was it 72nd in Lexington?
So you're kind of... You've got a New Yorker in you.
Yeah.
It looked like this. It was the same sort of neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well...
But
I was a senior in high school, and I was, you know, had to make the decision, where are you going to go to college? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to study guitar. And it was like, well, either I go to Manus or I go back to L.A.
Right.
And
you're 18 at this point?
Yeah. And I didn't know anything about classical guitar. That was the funny thing, that one of the main reasons I went to USC was they had a studio guitar and classical guitar department.
Yeah.
And I still sort of thought of myself as being like a jack of all trades kind of guy. And I thought, that sounds really cool. But the absolute most important reason was I just wanted to go back to California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here. Same issue.
Well, the thing is, my teacher said, there's this guy there who's teaching, and his name's Pepe.
Yeah, something Romero. Like that.
And I'm like, I don't know who that is. You know, and it was just such dumb luck that I just fell into...
To the biggest guitar department probably in the United States.
Right. And you know...
Especially at that time. You were part of that Segovia Masterclass and all that stuff?
In 1980, 3 years later. I mean, I met all the guys in the quartet. You know, I met my wife, played for Segovia, studied with Pepe. It's like my life completely changed because of that one decision. And I always sometimes wonder... You know, it's one of those, you know, parallel universe things. If I had gone to New York.
To Juilliard or something.
Well, there was no...
Juilliard, there was no program.
Yeah,
so you had to go to
Manus. If I'd gone to Manus, how would my life be different?
Very different.
I guess it would.
Very different.
But
I mean,
there's
no way
you can never go back.
You are of the golden era of the USC mafia. You know what I mean?
When I was a young punk, you know, I just didn't know anything when I arrived there.
Silver.
And to see some of the players who were there, it was amazing.
Who'd you have there when you were there at 18?
Well, there was the people who ended up forming the Defia trio, mm-hmm. Ian Krause, Kenton Youngstrom, and Terry Graves, who sadly has passed away now. Tom Wong was amazing. I don't know if you know any of these people, but the best player, one of the best players I ever heard was this girl who was studying there. She was from the Philippines, named Agnes Narciso. She was amazing. And she played in the Segovia
Masterclass. Yeah.
She was just a beautiful musician.
Who's the guy who played the Chaconne during that master? I forget.
Are you talking about Chapdelaine?
No, not Michael Chapdelaine.
Oh, okay.
Did he go to USC?
No. No.
No, I didn't think so.
No, he performed in the Segovia class in 86.
Oh, okay.
I didn't play in that one. But in the 81, who played the Chaconne?
I don't know. I thought somebody did. I might be wrong.
It was a long time ago. I don't remember that.
Yeah. But, so, I mean, as far as the California thing, when you came out, what was it? Because that's the thing. Those are very formative years.
Oh, yeah.
7 to 11. I mean, I pretty much feel like I'm kind of the same person. I don't know. Not really that, but like that's pretty much where you make those decisions. I remember I moved from Los Angeles to Stockton, which is like moving from heaven to hell, you know.
I know Stockton.
Stockton's
well.
A tough town.
I know Stockton.
So
yeah.
You know, but the thing is I had decided that I liked big cities because I got a chance to live down there. Was that a lot? I mean, well, you were near a big city, so was it the beach? I mean,
No, we lived in the San Fernando Valley.
The weather, the
suburban,
climate, the people.
The weather, it was just sun-drenched. Everything was in Polaroid, you know, colors, you know, and for me. And it was this carefree time, but it was, I had two older brothers, and I hung around with their friends almost more than I hung around with my friends. Hey, Billy, you know.
Yeah.
And a number of them played guitar, and that was when folk music was really starting.
67, you said, right?
67 to 71. Like one of my brother's old friends, you know, showed me how to play Blackbird.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I just kind of picked it up, and they thought, "Wow, this little kid's picking this up pretty quick." Yeah. And some of my brothers had these, you know, cute girlfriends, you know, and I was like, "Hey, this is a good way to meet girls," you know.
But yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's
little did I know that I would spend all of high school locked in the practice room, you know.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, playing music that the little girls did not want to listen to.
Did not, because by then I was playing all this esoteric stuff. But I guess that's when I sort of fell in love with the idea of being a guitar player, and it wasn't, you know. It wasn't just classical at that time. I mean, it was, you know, I was really into, you know, James Taylor and the Beatles and, you know, Joni Mitchell and later, of course, you know, like the Yes and Jethro Tull and King Crimson and Gentle Giant and stuff.
I mean,
like
you
that.
Seem young. You seem younger than 11.
No, I'm
and
old.
67.
I'm quite old. I'm actually.
How old are you?
I'm 50.
Do you want to say? You don't have to.
No, I'm 53.
53. Why don't you look like you're 43. You look 10 years younger.
I think your eyes are going.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I'm not just saying that. I'm not, you know, just, well, I'm sure everybody's going to think I'm just kissing your ass, but I'm not.
It's clean living, my friend. No, it's I don't know. Yeah.
Anyway.
It is what it is.
Go ahead.
The thing is that I loved all kinds of styles of guitar, and I didn't, in high school especially, I didn't see myself as a classical guitar specialist.
Yeah.
You know, my hero was Steve Howe from Yes.
Yeah,
and I thought he plays, you know, Chet style country and jazz and full on rock and you know, and a little classical and flamenco. And then when I arrived at USC, I thought, oh, I can be a studio/classical player. And then I heard the studio guys and I was like, oh, I'm not a blues player. I'm not a jazz player.
Yeah.
And then Pepe really sort of, you know, I still remember him saying this. He goes, Bill, the electric guitar is like a cupcake. It's delicious to eat, but it won't satisfy you. You know,
and is that the way he always talked?
Yes, he always talks. You know, and so he kind of encouraged me, you know, to really focus on classical guitar, and I sold my Les Paul, which I should have kept because
that's good
of
him because he didn't need to do that. You know, he could have just been dismissive.
He saw something in you. He saw something, and yeah. and he encouraged me to really focus. And
was there something to see there? Were you a young virtuoso, or were you just an inspired? I mean.
Well, I don't think I wasn't like Scott Tennant when he was like 14 and he first played for Pepe at a masterclass in Houston. Pepe called him Super Kid.
Yeah, Super Kid. You
know, he had these natural abilities.
He can play anything.
And just incredible dexterity and speed. And I was a, you know, a solid player, but I think I didn't play that different from I do now, the way I do now in some ways. I feel like I had a sort of a certain musicality that came out
musicality.
when I played. Right. And I had to refine it, and I had all kinds of bad habits that, you know, I'm still working on. But, you know, he saw something in me, and I think my concept of sound was always there. You know, that's kind of my thing. You know, it's just like that to explore the sonic capabilities of the guitar, you know, like how you can really modulate the sound and how important it is to get a rich singing tone. So maybe that's what he saw. I don't know.
But
he was very kind.
You were musical.
I'd like to hope so. I'd like to think so.
Well, that is. I mean, that's the thing. You're either this wonderkind, or you are. I don't know. Somebody with some heart. But the thing, I'm not saying, you know, that other people don't have heart. But I mean, that's the thing. Is you're well rounded. I mean, you listen, like you said. You're Joni Mitchell, James Taylor. I've always found the same thing. I don't just listen to classical. It can grate on you.
Well, and the thing that's still almost embarrassing about when I first arrived at USC was what a neophyte I was in terms of classical guitar. I mean, I had never met another classical guitarist other than my teacher until I got to USC.
Right.
You know, I didn't, and I still remember, it's so embarrassing. It was like my third or fourth week at USC, and Pepe was practicing, and I said, "Oh, can I listen to you practice? Do you mind?" He goes, "No." And I was literally sitting on the floor staring up at him, and he plays this piece, and he finishes, and I said, "Wow, that was amazing. What piece was that?" And he looks at me, and he goes, "It was the Concerto de Aranjuez." You know, like you, but he didn't say, "You idiot." You know, he was kind about it, but I didn't even know what piece that was. You know, but now I know. You know?
Azabajik gave a concert in Texas when I was a kid. I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And he played something, and I go, "Yeah, what was that piece by Navarez?" And he goes, What? And it was a whole room filled with, you know, Steve Kostelnik, Matt Hensley was there. It was all these older kids, and I was like, "Yeah, Navarez." And he goes, "You mean Narvaez?" And I was like, "Yeah." And I mean, everybody laughed, and I was just like, "Shit, I got to start listening to more music. I got to get into this."
Well, we all could learn more.
Yeah,
you know, that's our opportunity.
But sometimes it feels like everybody knows everything but you. You know,
true. But you know, if you remain open, you know, we'll all learn. You know, so.
Keep our hearts open.
Yeah.
So you went to California. You said you did Manus Prep, and then you went to California straight as an undergraduate to USC. Did you stay there? Did you do more? Did you get a master's? Or
I was 4 years at USC for my bachelor's, and I stayed on and got my master's. And in a ridiculous quirk of good luck, right when I finished my master's, one of the part-time teachers decided to basically retire from guitar and get a degree in psychology or something. So they had this very, very part-time opening at USC. So I immediately joined the faculty, which was pretty interesting to go 1 year from being a student and now I'm a teacher.
And now you're a 23-year-old faculty
member. Yeah. And so I've been at USC continuously since 1977.
Do you ever get sick of it?
I mean, love USC.
You love USC.
It's my home.
After this long, 18 you know, to this, I mean, that's 30 years at USC, 30, 40 years at USC now.
34 years, yeah. Oh my God. And my daughter is a cinema major there. She's studying animation. You know,
does she get a perk because her dad's on the faculty?
We get a little help, you know, but she did. She had to get in on her own accord. It's very competitive.
How old is she?
She's a sophomore.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people might have seen her work. She actually did a cover of...
Yeah, what's her name?
Her name's Camille. Mm-hmm. And she did a cover of Soundboard magazine last year. And when we did our Don Quixote show...
Yeah, sure.
All of the slides, all of the artwork, she designed all the artwork in the Don Quixote show. So she's a very talented artist.
She's a good kid.
Yeah, and very fond of her. She's
good. How many kids do you have?
Just Camille.
Just Camille?
Yeah, just one. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so that's good. So you like having kids? I don't know whether I'm going to have a kid or not. I'm on the fence.
I would highly recommend it. I mean, you know, we're so lucky with Camille. You know, she's a wonderful, kid who's, very empathetic.
And she's nice. She's always been nice to you.
She's been nice to me.
That's my I'm afraid they're going to stop being nice, and then I don't know how I would take that. Because even I have young kid students, and I can't stand it when they're in a bad mood and they don't want to talk.
Yeah, yeah. You know, every kid's different, so you never know what you're going to get. My wife is a special education teacher, uh-huh. and so she deals with, children with, talk about three strikes against them. You know, like one of her kids, remember she said, he was born in jail addicted to crack, and it's like, what kind of start are you going to get?
Right.
And some of these kids are, have, severe emotional disturbances, or they're, they're autistic or whatever. And so you never know if you're going to... And we just lucked out with Camille that she's, a very empathetic person, and she's and.
Yeah, you say empathetic now a lot. I mean, what do you mean by that?
I think some kids have a little trouble like seeing outside of themselves. You know, they're self-contained, and
yes.
it's sort of like the ability to see, well, how does this person feel?
Right.
You know, it's
not a normal part of childhood.
Yeah. Well, some do it naturally, and some don't, and and. Our relationship was always sort of that my wife, she's a fantastic mother, but it was sort of like, okay, Colette, you're in charge of discipline and I'm in charge of fun.
Right.
Yeah. So my relationship with Camille has always been kind of like, ooh, let's clean this up before mom gets home,
right.
kind of thing.
You're the playful dad.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I was, wait till your mother gets home, kind of thing, And we have the same, warped sense of humor. I like indoctrinated her into like the complete works of Monty Python, and
right.
She knows every single Beatles song. You know, there were certain things, that she simply had to know. But it's nice. And when she was first born, I thought, wow, well, there goes practicing. I thought, all my time is going to be gone. But what happened was I felt like my playing deepened.
Yep.
And
that's what they say.
And my practice time became much more focused and concentrated because it was more limited. I couldn't just practice for hours.
That's like Louis C.K., the comedian, said the same thing about him. His career took a sharp turn when when he had his two girls. He said that because then he knew that he had to do it. He had to be a productive person so that they would see that their dad was really not just working and not just providing, but also like doing. Fulfilling his dream.
And also accountable in a way.
Right.
In a way you sort of, you can't...
Not just financially accountable, but also...
Morally, in a way.
A compass.
Yeah. And, it's been helpful for me.
Does she know who her dad is? Does she know... I mean, she knows probably now, but I mean, growing up, did she know that her dad was like this Grammy Award winning...
Well, it's a long time ago when she was really young. It sort of dawned on her that, I was... well known, and she said, "Daddy, are you famous?" And I said, "I'm famous with an incredibly small number
of
people."
Yes, that's right.
None
of your friends at school are going to know who I am.
No, absolutely not. And it actually it brought up this idea. Well, how many people need to know you to be considered famous?
Because kids want you to be famous.
Well, is it 100? Is it 1,000? Is it 10,000? Like, if you go viral on YouTube, does that mean you're famous? What defines fame? But in my own little completely puny, nerdy world of classical guitar, I guess I am famous.
Yes, you are famous.
But outside
in
that,
world.
I'm
no, you are not.
Wonderfully anonymous. I'm just...
You can
just
walk down the street.
Joe Schmo.
Yeah, you can walk down the street and
absolutely.
There's no paparazzi outside.
Not at all.
Except for Soundboard Magazine. There's
right.
one Soundboard Magazine photographer outside of your apartment all the time.
That's right. Exactly. And they come up to you and they go... What kind of strings do you use?
Yeah, right. That's the thing. It's like we
can I
will
see
never...
your nails?
And that's the thing we have to explain to these kids. I always got to say, because they can't believe. They're like, well, if you're not famous, that's it, right? Then you should do something else. Maybe you should go downtown and work with Daddy on Wall Street or something.
I guess, what I find much more fulfilling than, how many people know me or respect me is simply that, I'm able to do something that I feel... is adding to the creative culture, recordings and concerts and arrangements that I've done, leaves a small legacy. And in a way, with my Don Quixote fixation that I had a few years ago when I did this project for with the quartet, The motivating factor for Don Quixote was a lot of people. I know I'm switching gears to Don Quixote, but I'll get back to it.
Please,
you know,
do.
It's that, you know, a lot of people think, oh, Don Quixote's motivation was he wanted Dulcinea, he wanted the girl, and it's like absolutely wrong. His fixation was to become immortal by leaving a legacy of through his actions.
Yes,
you know, and in a way, you know, we see that today in many different fields, and it's not that I have this grand scheme or want to, you know, create immortality, but I feel that by leaving good works, you know, and right. enhancing the art of our field, you're doing something positive, and that's. If that then makes you know gets you known, great. You
so
know,
you're going down a course towards immortality.
Well, I wouldn't say it in that way.
That's
but,
not.
but you know, I just feel like it's incumbent upon us as artists to further our art all the
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
and that's deeply fulfilling when you're able to do that, and if you can get paid for it, it's fantastic. And
right.
so I really consider myself ridiculously fortunate. You know, I remember talking to the guys in the quartet years ago. You know, we were on some difficult tour, you know, like something got canceled or we had to head up early for a master class or a flight or and you know, the guys are just carping and this sucks. And I sort of turned to them and I said, "Do you guys realize that we hit the guitar lottery?" You know,
right.
I mean, we're playing concerts for a living and
right.
people are coming and they're buying our records and we're doing this cool stuff and it's and I sort of try to not forget that. I try to not take it for granted.
Because it probably is easy to take it for granted.
It is.
I mean, you know, just get pissed off at stuff.
You get old and you get crabby. You know, it's
yeah.
like, you know, that old thing of, you know, I can't complain, but I'm going to anyway, you know.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, but I feel like...
Most of the time because there's nothing else to talk about.
Right.
Especially with four guys.
Well, things can always be better and easier and pay more or whatever, but it's
right.
it's like we're so fortunate. It's so difficult in today's world to get ahead. We were lucky because we were unique, you know, 25 years ago. It was like, hey, these guys are cool, and we established ourselves just at
well,
the
you
right
guys are the
time.
First... I mean, to me, I mean... you know, I had three CDs when I was a kid. One of them was the Assads, one of them was John Williams, and one of them was an LA Guitar Quartet CD.
Well,
so the thing is,
thank you for putting
well,
this
that's
in
the
that
truth.
Category.
But the thing is, what are you talking about? Of course. But the thing is, you guys are really the first, I think, like internationally recognized guitar quartet. Is that fair to say?
No, it's not, because the Romeros trump us completely.
That's, well, okay,
you know.
Yeah, okay.
But what. And we owe so much to the Romeros. I mean, Pepe, who's been, you know, a dear
you
friend.
You guys all are USC Pepe Romero.
Yeah, yeah.
Angel Romero.
Yeah, I mean, John studied with Celine first.
Okay.
And Matt studied with Pepe, but not as much. Scott and I are really Pepe guys.
Yeah, right.
In fact, Scott and I first met each other.
Yeah, let's talk about that, like
well,
how it all started.
Well, I had been at USC for a year and a half, or maybe 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an annual summer master class in Houston that a dear friend of Pepe's used to put on. And I went, actually flew with Pepe. It was so cool. I flew to Houston, and I was going to meet this guy, Scott Tennant, who I already knew all about. He was super kid, you know, this guy. And he was going to be coming to USC that September. And I was almost thinking, was it going to be like this competitive thing? Are we going to be, you know, like... You know, who's the top dog here kind of thing.
Right.
And I arrive at this little guitar store. Scott and I meet 5 minutes after we meet. We've got our guitars out, and we're reading through the Girardia movement of the Concerto Madrigal. It's like I met him, and in 5 minutes, we were playing together.
Why? How? I mean,
just, it
was he
just,
already playing? He already
yeah,
sat
we just,
down?
We just, it was like, here, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. Let's play something. Boom. And it's like, and so Scott and I... played with each other from the first moment we met each other. It's really
I mean, sight reading. That yeah. was probably nerve wracking.
Yeah. No, that's it was just what we wanted to do. And
okay.
and so when he came to USC in September, you know, Pepe, you know, put us in a quartet, and John Dearman was there, and at that time Anissa, and we just started this little quartet, and
yeah.
But we owed so much to Pepe, you know, for putting us together. And also Jim Smith, he doesn't get enough credit. Jim Smith was the teacher at USC for, you know, for 30 years, and he really coached us a lot. A lot of our early arrangements we played were Jim Smith's arrangements.
See, those guys get wiped. Our guy at Manus was
Valdez Blaine.
Terry From my era, was Terry Chaplin. You ever mean?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's just... I'm afraid he's going to be lost to obscurity because of his sort of... He doesn't have students that are his students.
Right.
But I always mention him in every bio because I'm like, he had such a profound effect on us.
Well,
those guys do.
Yeah. Jim was great. And you know,
they aren't your teacher per se, but they...
Well, Jim
your
was
coach.
Actually...
They're
Jim
one of your
was,
coaches.
Jim was my... private
he was your
instructor.
Private instructor before
yeah.
so you had to get through
yeah.
him to get to
yeah well Pepe didn't teach weekly lessons, he was too busy for that, he right. just came in and taught master classes
yeah back know? Then he was yeah. the hottest shit on earth too
yeah well that was during the heady days you know yeah. But we also and so to answer your question of before, you know, the Romeros of course are the, you know, the not the first professional guitar quartet, actually there are quite a few that preceded them, but the first that really became a huge international thing. Mm-hmm. They were touring, you know, on community concert series. They were, you know, played for the Pope, and they played on Johnny Carson, and you know, and played for Carter. You know, I mean, they were huge stars, and continued to tour. And you know, but when we started up, you know, we kind of realized, especially a few years in, that we couldn't be like, you know, Romero varsity team. You know, we couldn't be like the little Romeros. You know, and in a way, that was one of the main reasons why we had our first personnel shift after about 10 years. Because Anissa was really, really into the Romero, you know, vibe.
Right.
And kind of didn't want to do stuff that was outside of their style and sort of want to just completely pay tribute to them.
And is this when you guys started doing the rock, well, or then, the Zeppelin and
well,
stuff
then
like
Andy
that?
York. Then Andy York joined the group.
Yeah.
And then he was writing pieces for us, and we started doing jazz.
And you
rock.
Two seem like you would be two peas in a pod.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Andy was, you know, incredibly creative guy, very strong. You know, he had a real, you know, I was sort of alpha dog, and he was an alpha dog, too. You know,
two opinions.
Yeah. And it was, but you know, we were together for 16 years. We did some amazing stuff together, and we're still really good friends. And, you know, we parted really, really convivially.
Amicably,
yeah. We made almost a conscious decision to say we're American guitarists. We grew up in the, you know, '60s. We're not guitarists from Malaga. You
yeah,
know, we should respect and represent the music that we grew up with, and sort of in a way the ultimate evocation of that was our Guitar Heroes record. You know,
right.
we did Chet Atkins and Pat Metheny and yeah. Zeppelin and paid tribute to the Romeros as well, and paid tribute to the Assads, who were so important to us.
Yeah, to all of us. Yeah.
Well, not just as an inspiration, the Assad. Like, I don't know if you know this, but we had been together for about a year and a half or so, and the Assads came to do a masterclass at USC, and we met them and we were hanging out with them,
mm-hmm.
and we were rehearsing at John's little funky like college dorm, and the Assads came to our rehearsal because they were just hanging out, and we were playing Jim Smith's arrangement of the Brandenburg and some other things, and Odair's like, you guys are good, you guys play pretty good. I think that's good, we should try to help you, try to get you something. I talked to my wife. And Odair's wife at the time, that's Odair, that's what he sounds like.
That is what he sounds like.
I know.
You're and, very good at these impressions.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second.
Oh, okay.
And Odair's wife was a very important record producer and concert promoter.
GSP Records.
GHA.
GHA, I'm sorry.
In Belgium.
Right.
And essentially our first international recording was done with them. Our first tours in Europe, all because of their influence. And they, for no reason that I could possibly find, they would go around, and when they would play concerts, they say, you know, there's this LA quartet. They're pretty good. You should try them.
Young guys.
And they had nothing to gain. And if it wasn't for them, I think our career wouldn't have taken off nearly as much as it did. And we owe them so much. You know, so we owe, you know, Pepe and the Romeros, but the Assads almost equally as much, you know. And you know, there's a few other people who are dear friends of mine that I respect greatly, who've also helped out. You know, David Russell was really kind to us early on, and Manuel, and you know, so we've been, you know, like I said, we hit the guitar lottery. We just kind of lucked out.
Yeah.
But you know, I guess people recognized that we were doing something a little different. You know, and
Well, there is a difference there, not just in nationality or style. It's also, you guys were a bunch of young American guys that weren't related to each other. I mean, that's sort of the fun of it. It's sort of like this, fraternity of musical, you know what I mean? It's a little more loose, and it looks like you guys, it's fun that way. I always like the brother and sister duos because they play really well, or the husband-wife duos, but there's something friendly about seeing two guys that aren't related, that are just friends. There's something a little bit light, and I'm attracted to that dynamic, rather than just the dad made sure that we both practiced really hard.
Right.
No offense to the Romeros at all. I'm just saying it's a totally different package.
Well, I sometimes try to analyze, what is it, that made us attractive, especially to European audiences? And when we first played there, we kind of smile like idiots sometimes when we're on stage. You know, we're like goofy, and it's like a picking and a grin. And I think the European audience is so shocked by this because they were used to like really serious, like really dour, like intense, and which is,
no talk.
And there can be some, incredibly deep and important and serious, wonderful performances that happen that way. But ours was a little bit more without being, like Las Vegas showbiz. We tried to have a little bit of an entertainment value to it, or it evince this sunny Californian spirit of like, just kind of laid back and having a good time, and this American ideal, as ephemeral as it is.
It's like they want American. Give them the American. Give them the
right. And when our name, when people think Los Angeles, they like, especially in Europe, they think sunny and, palm trees and, people
girls
are smiling. none of us are from LA, of course, and none of us have tans or, are even remotely attractive, but maybe the spirit of, just kind of, there's no real barrier. Like, well, sure, let's play klezmer music. Let's play Indonesian music. Let's play a jazz tune. Let's do Bach, but do this, weird thing with it, And maybe that's one of the keys to our success. I don't know. That we're just sort of have a devil may care attitude a little bit.
And also when you guys did it, that was the first time that was done. Nobody was playing. Maybe there was some Lennon McCartney, but there was not to the extent of taking American pop music from the 60s and 70s in particular, or like you're saying, just klezmer music and infusing that into
classical
what
guitar.
Is still a classical ensemble.
Right.
You guys are not amplifying. There's, you're playing at the Y, you're playing at,
We weren't the first kind of crossover act. I mean, we were deeply influenced by, like stuff that Kronos Quartet was doing and Turtle Island.
That's Turtle Island.
And, things like that. And
I'm talking about guitar. Right. I guess guitar.
And there are other guitar composers and groups that were doing really interesting stuff. We were really influenced by a wonderful group.
Were you really? Go ahead.
Well, called the Amsterdam Guitar Trio. They were a big influence on us. And of course, the Assads of what they were doing.
And Kronos.
As well. Yeah.
I mean, Kronos is huge.
So it wasn't like we were the first guys to think of it. But I guess one thing I could admit is that we have a sort of personality. Like, we have a way of playing and a style and a sort of.
Yeah, there is a difference between the way that they played that Jimi Hendrix, Kronos Quartet.
Right.
They still have, like, this Germanic sort of presence, this heaviness.
Right.
Like you're saying. I mean, they'll do that and then they'll. I mean, not with you guys.
Well, I hope so.
There's not a.
That is Jimi Hendrix, yeah? No. Anyway, they're not from Germany. They're from San Francisco.
I'm just saying they have that sort of presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. They seem really heady and.
We do what we do, for some reason, it seems the topic here is sort of focusing on these tipping point moments, like the tipping point moment for me in New York, deciding whether to go to New York or LA. And the tipping point of when the quartet first got together, and the decision, sort of a deliberate decision that I made of, I had won the Toronto competition in 1981, so it was like, I'm going to be Mr. Big Shot, soloist. And right after that was the Segovia Masterclass, and all of the members of the quartet were one of the 12.
You, Dierman, everybody,
Scott, and there were 12 of us who played. And it was like, this is a really big deal. We're playing for Segovia. Well, there was an afternoon concert during that week, and the quartet played, and it was really the first kind of official recital we did. Like, we were still called the USC Guitar Quartet, but we played, and a bunch of people heard it, and I got a note, a handwritten note from Mike Lorimer, you know, who's a dear friend of mine. He lives right around the corner from here. Michael Lorimer, great musician, guitarist. And he wrote something, and he said, you know, that guitar quartet is pretty special. Don't give it up.
Huh.
Like he, and I really took that to heart, and it was like, I thought, you know, there's a lot of great soloists out there, but, you know, maybe he's right. There's something special about this quartet. And so I pretty deliberately, I didn't completely subjugate my solo career, but I put, over the years, over the 32 years that the quartet's been together, I've put a lot of time and effort into it, you know, right. Like, and not just, you know.
How many quartet albums?
We've recorded 13 or 14 CDs.
As opposed to, I mean, you have like four or five solo albums.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I've arranged a bunch of stuff. I mean, there's a small, pretty small pile, you know,
right.
I don't know, it's 10 hours of music or something I've arranged, you know, and it's not just that, I'm sort of like.
You were the arranger especially now with York gone, you're the kind of arranger in residence.
Well,
right?
I did tons during.
Oh, when you were doing that before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Andy, you know, arranged a couple of pieces for us and then wrote tons of great pieces for us. But I've arranged, you know, one of the first things I did for us way, way before Andy joined the group. And right at the beginning of our time together, I did the complete El Amor Brujo by Faya. That was like our first big statement piece. You know, done a ton of stuff, you know. But it's not just the arrangements. It's sort of, you know, I'm kind of like part of the engine that keeps pushing the quartet forward. You know, it's like, what are we going to do next? And I sort of take care of a lot of the day-to-day, you know, managerial and organizational things. And I drive the guys nuts. You know, I drive them crazy because I'm sort of, you know, control freak and you know, annoying. But, you know, they realize that, you know, they couldn't live without me. You know,
right, yeah.
You know, it takes that kind of, you know, obsessive personality in a way.
And are you obsessive? So you're obsessive with the phrasing. I mean, you want everybody's rhythm to be correct.
No.
Is that you?
Not. I try really hard not to be dogmatic or bossy when it comes to our musical decisions. I try really hard. I think I used to be more, and I've learned to, you know, to give space. And I'm more of a managerial guy with just the day to day operations. It's like we need, you know,
booking air flights.
Yeah, flights, and we have to organize this, and what are we doing? And
you guys don't have someone to do that for you?
No, I do it.
Oh,
yeah, almost all of it.
What about the management?
They help, but
oh, so your management too? Your self?
No, we have a manager here in New York.
Yeah, I would think. Oh, but yeah, what's his name?
Frank Solomon.
Oh, okay, but you're solo with.
My solo manager is Robert Besson.
Robert Besson, and he's here too. I think,
he's in Hoboken. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
But you know, it's just that. I subscribe to the axiom that if you want something done right, you do it yourself. And you know, so we need program notes written. We need, you know, somebody's got to edit this CD. And I just do it.
Yeah.
And it drives my wife crazy sometimes because she sees all the time I spend. You know.
Yeah, you're sitting in front of the TV designing a CD cover. She's like, can't you just let somebody else design your CD
cover? And I'm like, I just can't let it go. You know. Yeah. You know, but. And I don't want anyone to get the idea that I do all the work in the quartet. It's not true.
No.
But you know, it's been in a sort of a life project of mine, you know, to create and sustain this ongoing activity that is the quartet. And because I realize that if you don't feed it and water it, you know, it will wither, you know, and it has to be sustained.
Have there been points where you felt like it was about to wither?
Definitely.
I mean, you guys went through a huge personnel change in the last 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the most dangerous time was about a year and a half before Andy left the group because Andy just, he just said, I need to take a break. And Scott was like, hey, count me in too, because I'm sick of traveling right now.
Oh, Jesus.
And so we took a 9-month hiatus.
Okay.
And in a way it was good for me because I sort of took that as a cue. It's like, well, maybe I need to like get a little more aggressive with my solo stuff.
Okay.
And that was around the time that my friend Shingo Fuji wrote this concerto for guitar and guitar orchestra. And so I just pushed that, and I did a bunch of performances doing that, and it was great. But then when the quartet came back together again, Andy said, you know, not doing it for me. I'm gonna leave the group. You know, and I thought we were at a tipping point where, you know, it was almost like, well, maybe we should just call it.
Yeah, you were thinking, maybe, I could do this.
Well,
yeah,
maybe I was thinking maybe that's it. But then, you know, we decided we're going to continue, and we did our search for a new member, and Matt worked out great, you know, and it's working really, really well. It's, you know, it's still hard. I mean, you know, traveling is rough on all of us, and we're getting older, you know, so it's not going to keep going forever, but
Matt's pretty young.
Matt's young. I was referring to me and John and Scott. We're all old. You know.
Would you guys let Matt continue taking the LA Guitar Quartet name, and like you and Scott probably pop off?
I don't know. We haven't. You know what? We haven't discussed. We haven't gone that far.
And just, I mean, you haven't thought about it as a brand,
haven't thought about it. You know, it's a very interesting question. I don't think anyone's ever asked that question, because you know, there's so many examples in the music world of, you know, the Juilliard String Quartet, the King's Singers. Right. You know,
when Mann left the string quartet, it's still.
Well, there's many groups that they still exist.
Yeah.
But and there's no original members anymore. It's everyone's changed.
Yes.
You know, and is it in fact the same group? You know,
and well, orchestras continue, and their sound, like the Berlin orchestra, you know, they still have the same sound.
Well, the King's Singers.
Right.
There's no original members, but they sound like the King's Singers.
They sound like them. Yeah.
So. The only thing is, I sort of find it hard to imagine us without the original three. Mm-hmm. Like it was like John and Scott and I. It's like, that's like the...
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like, well, did the Beatles say, well, you know, if John wants to retire, we'll get another guy to fill in for John, you know. And yeah. I'm not comparing ourselves to the Beatles.
Right.
But, you know, I have a feeling that you know, if it comes to, there was something always about the third chair that, you know, it's had three different members and we've been able to like sustain it without.
It's like a drummer in a rock band.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Poor Matt.
Well, it's the one. Wasn't it in Spinal Tap? The drummer kept exploding.
And yeah, he kept on dying. Yeah.
Yeah. All that was left was a small green globule. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, no Spinal Tap references.
That's fine.
Yeah, but. You know, who knows? You know, you never know what's going to happen. But there's no substitute for having played with two other guys for 32 years. I mean, you know, like we get up on stage and it's like, even if we're, you know, tired and we're bickering or whatever, we sit down and we start playing. It's like lock, you know, and mm-hmm. we just can get into this sort of.
Especially with the three of you there, it's just this that sort of is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like a telepathic. Lock.
And how, I mean, you know, without going into too much detail, but do you really get along, or do you guys just sort of not talk as much? Because I know...
We get along. We definitely, I mean, we're buddies. When we're on the road, we always go out together. We've learned, though, that when we're home, and we're all really busy, because we're all teaching like crazy, and we all live in different places. Matt's married and has two young kids, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, John and Scott are really busy teaching, so we rarely like just get together and hang out in LA when we're, you know, just for fun. We rarely do that.
Did you guys ever do that before?
We did. And there are certain like LA quartet like traditions. Like I always have this Christmas party, you know, and everyone's always there, and we always do this gift thing.
And sometimes that's all you need for a friendship is once a year.
Yeah.
Saying we have to hang out for once a year and just.
And it seems like Scott's birthday has now become the new tradition. We always get together for Scott's birthday.
Oh, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah. So that's nice. And when, you know, friends of ours come and visit, you know, like David Russell comes to town or you know, the Assads or something, try to all get together.
After a master class or something.
So it's not like, you know, there's some famous string quartet where, you know, they deliberately fly on four separate airplanes, stay in four separate hotel rooms, you know, and not see each other until backstage. We're not like that at all. We travel together. And it's just that we learned that we need to respect our own space and privacy when we're not on the road, because we need to like decompress from it, mm-hmm. you know. And my wife, you know, she kind of wants to see me when I'm home.
You know? And that's the thing too. If you call them up just to like have a casual conversation about the game or whatever,
right.
You're gonna end up
right.
slipping into like this. So, well, what's going on with Sunday?
I know. Right.
Well, we're flying out at 4 and all that shit.
I know. And I'm the worst at that.
You enjoy talking about
it. I just can't help myself.
Yeah, I can't either.
You know,
yeah.
And so I have to try really hard to like not go into business mode.
Yeah.
You know, when
because it's an easy thing. It's easy to just, when you don't have anything to talk about, it's easy, like we said, to complain is easy. Yes. And to talk about business is easy.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. But you gotta avoid that.
And I take up as certain people have pointed out, I like to take up all the air in the room sometimes. No. Without realizing I'm doing it. But it's just my personality. I can't help it. No. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you said to me one time. We went out to lunch and you were like, hey, you know, you wrote, sorry for talking the entire time. I was like, you didn't. You didn't really talk the whole time.
Okay.
No, and also, no. Yeah. So anyway, you got to get back, right? You got to get back to Harris Becker.
Yeah. Well, this was a fun weekend. You know, I played a solo recital last night.
You drove out here just for this, right?
I did.
That is so nice of you.
Yeah. It was, well, I'm happy to do it.
Dude, you're going to make this podcast, right? Yeah. I mean, unbelievable.
Well, I played a solo recital here for Harris, and it's actually the second time I've played solo on that festival.
This is the Long Island International.
Wow, guitar festival.
Guitar.
And the quartet's played on it twice, and it's really fun. And really good friends of mine are playing tonight, Eden Stell from England. They're great.
Yeah, awesome guitar.
But I had a lot of fun. There was a group of young students who drove all the way up in this big bus from Orlando to play in this like guitar ensemble showcase, and they when I was playing my recital.
How many of them are there?
Well, I think only 2/3 of the kids in the whole group could make it because it was expensive. They had to pay.
Right.
But there had to be like 30 of them. There had to be 30 of them in this group.
Huh.
And most of them in my concert were sitting like right in the front row. And when I was talking to the audience in between pieces, I could just see these kids, and they were so jazzed about it. They were so enthusiastic and like just smiling. And it really made me feel like relaxed and that, you know, I was conveying this like fun message to these kids. You know, it put me in a really good mental state. And you know, sometimes when you look out at an audience, you know, you can just sort of sense that, you know, they're critical. You know, there's a guy with a little mistake, the glitch counter.
It's not the worst audience, but it is the least enjoyable. Right. Out of all the audiences, is
the guitar festival.
The guitar festival.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, his nails or his strings or, you know.
They're like looking for tips instead of listening to you
right.
play.
And these kids were just, they were transcending all of that. And I felt like I was just going right to the source of music, you know, sharing
music. You're
like
at a music festival now.
Exactly. And so I was really happy I got to hear them play today. And they did a beautiful job. And you know, for me, like this whole idea of kids learning, you know, high school kids especially, learning the guitar and doing these guitar ensembles, it's something I've been really involved with for years. I mentioned briefly in passing the Shingo Fuji, my friend from Kyoto.
The composer.
Yeah, he wrote a piece for me. It's got to be 7 years ago now, this piece called Concerto de Los Angeles, and it's for guitar and guitar orchestra, and I've played it. You know, we did it in Japan a bunch of times. We did it in China, and I've played it in many places in the U.S. I did it in New York with students from Manus, Manhattan, and Juilliard last year, or 2 years ago.
At the symposium?
No, I did it for the Guitar Society.
Okay, cool.
I had one of their concerts at Baruch University, and for me, it's such a great thing to do because, you know, I'll play my normal solo set, and then I'll bring these students out to play with me. And we've worked really hard together on this piece, and they've studied, and they're following a conductor, and you know they play at a professional concert, you know. And for me, it's a really great learning experience for them, and the audience seems to really love it. And I think it's left a pretty nice mark, you know, like a memory for the students involved, you know, that it was like, you know, oh, I had to be professional. You know, I had to be on time and know my part and dress right and be in tune and follow and be together. I'm accountable. And this is part of a real, it's not just this, you know, idea, oh, I'm going to play guitar for people. It's like, no, this is real. And it was, you know, having that has been really great for me. And I actually, about 2 years ago, asked Shingo to write a piece for the quartet with guitar orchestra. And it was dedicated to the victims of the tsunami. And we did a tour in last March, and in four or five concerts, played it with over 500 guitar students.
Were the guitar students from Japan? Or?
No, this was in the U.S. We did it. Oh, we premiered it in Virginia. We did it at a guitar ensemble
festival. So not only are they getting to play with you guys, they're also the whole cause, all that stuff, the whole synergy of everything.
Yeah, and Shingo was conducting them. He came from Japan.
Yeah.
I don't want to make a pitch necessarily, but there's a beautiful video of this, the premiere, mm-hmm. that it's just a little bit of the performance, but these beautiful interviews with Shingo and with me and with some of the students. And it's
Shingo spelled S-H-I-N-G-O.
Exactly. Yeah. Shingo Fuji, F-U-J-I-I.
Right.
But if you go to, you know, Vimeo?
Yeah, sure, It's a lot of music videos.
So if you go to Vimeo and you put in Journey to Shiki, S-H-I-K-I, mm-hmm. there's this beautiful little 10-minute film that the students at this little high school made.
Yeah.
And it's very deep, I think, you know, because it really shows the way that the kids were affected by the experience and Shingo's emotion of it. And it's a real beautiful thing. And I believe in that, you know, we need to foster, you know, young kids who want to learn classical guitar, because I believe the children are our future.
No, and also, especially in the United States, that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Because we start so much later.
But it's happening. It's
happening now.
There's programs all over the country now that are, Loudoun County, Virginia, Fairfax County, Virginia, Albuquerque, Las Vegas, of course, Austin, Texas is the center of it. And there's other places around the country now where it's in Florida and, you know, New York State. Yeah. It's great, and we're going to see like this. Not all of them are going to become professional guitarists.
Yeah,
but they
not the point.
But they're trained and they love it and they appreciate it
and they'll be able to listen to it
exactly. And they're audiences for it. And they come to they go to a, it's like they know who David Russell
no,
is.
No, that's the know? Thing is that's I mean everybody wants to know. A lot of my friends who don't play, it is. It's all about music education. If you don't have the education, you're not. It's like if you don't know how to read. You're not going to be able to read a good book if you can only read certain. If you only have like a vocabulary of a couple of hundred words, you're not going to be able to read anything cool or fun.
Right.
So anyway, well, that's it. Well, thanks so much for visiting.
Oh, my pleasure.
I want to make sure we get to that car before it gets towed.
Towed away. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Yeah. Don't want to be impounded in the city.
I don't want you to be impounded. You're going to miss Eden Stell that way.
Thanks a lot, pal.
How about that guy, huh? Bill Kenningkaiser. What a sweetheart. Anyway, so listen, the thing is, I was unable to find one of his recordings on MP3. I've got some Melly Guitar Quartet CDs, though, so I was able to, you know, pull one off there. Bill, if you're listening, if you would... I didn't have time to go and buy a CD. Otherwise, I would have, and I would have, you know, whatever, converted it. But a little bit of a time crunch. So here's the LA Guitar Quartet playing the Brandenburg Concerto No. 6 by Johann Sebastian Bach. I hope you guys enjoy it. I hope you join me next week when I'm back with John Olson, the president of the New York Classical Guitar Society. And also, he went to MIT. So, you know, he could have had it any old way. And he chose to stick with us. And that always surprises me. So anyway, I'll see you guys next week. Thanks for joining me. Again, Los Angeles Guitar Quartet. Enjoy the outro. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.